And it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And I suggest that you have a pencil and paper handy. Just so if there's something that you feel is important enough to write down, you can do it. Because there's lots of information going to come at you here. Let's start off with our announcement. Snapshot Day, the Coastal Watershed Council is going to be having their Water Monitoring Day, which they call Snapshot Day, on Saturday, May 4th. Snapshot Day is only 3.5 weeks away, and folks, we need your help. This year's event is the 14th Annual Water Quality Monitoring Event, providing a snapshot of water quality along 300 miles of California coastline. In partnership with the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary and hundreds of community volunteers, the Coastal Watershed Council will systematically sample streams that flow into the Pacific Ocean during this one-day event. And they've done this every year for 14 years. I've been at a few of them. At CWC, we're organizing teams of volunteers to monitor sites across Santa Cruz and San Mateo counties. The Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary will organize teams for Monterey and San Luis Obispo counties. There is a training, and they'll train you to collect valuable water quality data such as pH, dissolved oxygen, electrical conductivity, and transparency. They also collect water samples for laboratory analysis of bacteria and nutrients like nitrates and orthophosphates. Learn more about why each of these indicators is important to watershed health and be a part of a growing movement. Learning what you can do as part of the solution. Get some friends and the family members and make it a fun day of caring about your environment on Saturday, May 4th. Now, you will need to go to one of these trainings in Santa Cruz. It's going to occur on Saturday, April 27th from 10 a.m. to noon and again from 1 to 3 p.m. That's Saturday, April 27th, 10 to noon or 1 to 3. At the Santa Cruz Yacht Harbor Public Meeting Room, that's located at 365 Lake Avenue, Suite A, which is right next door to the Coastal Watershed Council. On San Mateo volunteers, your training is on Monday, April 29th from 6 to 8 p.m. up at George's San Gregorio General Store at Highway 84 and Stage Road. In Monterey, your training is Sunday, April 28th. From 10:30 to 12:30 in the morning at the REI store on General Stillwell Drive down there in Seaside. Or is it Marina? I can't tell. And it's definitely not Monterey, you know. Anyway, San Luis Obispo, your training is on Tuesday, April 30th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Coastal Discovery Center, Hearst State Beach in San Simeon. And it's a fun day, folks, so make it a point to get out there and get trained and then get on out to Coastal Watershed Council's Snapshot Day. There's been some action this last week. An Oklahoma grandmother has locked herself to the Keystone XL heavy machinery down in Oklahoma. Tuesday, Oklahoma grandma Nancy Zorn, 79 years old, from War Acres, locked herself to a piece of heavy machinery, effectively halting construction on TransCanada's Keystone XL pipeline. The action came in the wake of a disastrous tar sands pipeline spill in Mayflower, Arkansas, where an estimated 80,000 gallons of tar sands oil spilled into a residential neighborhood and local waterways. And you ought to check into that one, because they instituted a no-fly zone and they're beating up on reporters, and that's a nasty one. Anyway, back to this story. Using a bike lock, Zorn attached her neck directly to a massive earth mover known as an excavator, which brought the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline to a stop. Zorn is the second Oklahoma grandmother this year risking arrest to stop construction of the pipeline, and her protest was third in the series of ongoing civil disobedience actions led by the Oklahoma-based coalition of organizations Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance. Right now, our neighbors in Arkansas are feeling the toxic effect of tar sands in their own community. Will Oklahoma neighborhoods be next? Asked Zorn before taking action. I can no longer sit idly by while toxic tar sands are pumped down from Canada and into our communities. It's time to rise up and defend our home. It is my hope that this one small action today will inspire many to protect this land and our water. ExxonMobil's recent Pegasus pipeline spill has forced local residents to evacuate their homes due to life-threatening toxins released into the neighborhood. Locals of families experienced episodes of nausea, headaches, and respiratory problems due to acute exposure to deadly chemicals like benzene that are mixed in with the raw tar sands. Pegasus was carrying up to 90,000 barrels of tar sands a day before it ruptured, a 22-foot-long rupture, and spilled. The Keystone Exxon pipeline, however, is slated to carry almost 10 times that much, or 800,000 barrels a day. In the last 2 weeks alone, there have been at least six different inland oil spills across the country, said Eric Wheeler, an Oklahoma native and spokesperson for the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance, including in Alaska. It's time to stop referring to pipeline spills as accidents. It's now abundantly clear that leaks are just a part of business as usual. Tar sands hurt everyone they touch, from the indigenous communities in Alberta whose water is being poisoned to the Gulf Coast communities that are forced to breathe toxic refinery emissions. We're not going to allow this toxic stuff in our beautiful state. Nancy Zorn, however, was later extracted from her Caterpillar excavator by local law enforcement and taken into custody. She made her statement. Meanwhile, Greenpeace polar bears are protesting Arctic drilling. Two Greenpeace activists dressed up as polar bears boarded an oil platform in Norway recently to protest against Norwegian oil and gas group Statoil's planned drilling in the Arctic. No oil company in the world is prepared for Arctic conditions, said the head of Greenpeace Norway, Truls Galausen, one of the two activists who boarded the West Hercules platform currently stationed in Olin in southwestern Norway. It is unacceptable that Statoil wants to gamble with safety and the environment in the vulnerable Arctic regions, he added in a statement. Greenpeace sent two polar bears to inspect the platform and to raise public awareness about the dangers of oil activities in the Arctic region with extreme climatic conditions and located far from mainland infrastructure. The West Hercules is scheduled to be sent this month to the Norwegian waters of the Barents Sea, which is normally ice-free, to conduct a prospecting campaign that is expected to last into 2014. The campaign, which calls for up to 9 drilling operations, including some in zones very far north, is already several months behind schedule. Preparing the platform took longer than expected, Statoil spokesman Ola Anders Skouby said. After changes to the West Hercules route, operations in the northernmost zones have been postponed but are still planned. We are always evaluating the pace of our drilling in light of our resources and our priorities, and there is nothing dramatic about the changes, Skouby said. After Shell and Statoil both postponed their respective drilling campaigns in Alaska, Greenpeace says it believes that the major oil companies are realizing how difficult it is to operate in the Arctic. The oil industry is beginning to understand that drilling in the Arctic is much more difficult than they had us believe, Galausen told AFP. According to a 2008 study by the U.S. Geological Survey, the Arctic could hold up to 22% of the world's undiscovered oil and gas reserves, resources which have become more accessible in recent years as the Arctic ice melts. Norway's oil production has been in steady decline for more than a decade, but the country recently raised its estimates for its oil and gas reserves due to the Barents Sea reserves. And Taiwan activists are praising their treetop man. Taiwan activists are praising one man's effort to bring about change to the environmental policies of this East Asian country through his demonstration atop a tree. Dubbed the treetop man, Pan Hung Chang has vowed to stay in his perch until a local council ends its controversial development project. I have so much respect for him and what he is doing, environmental activist Li Zun told Baikian News. .com as the protest entered its 12th day on Monday. The government of New Taipei City, on the outskirts of the capital, plans to build a swimming pool and an underground parking garage on the grounds of a junior high school in the Panqiao district. Despite objections from conservationists, some nearby residents and alumni and teachers of the school, a contractor started removing 5 out of the 32 targeted 40-year-old trees from the campus late last month. In reaction, activist Pan, aged 46, climbed one of the trees on March 28th and has refused to come down with meals and water supplied by his supporters on the ground. We will supply him with what he needs until the government changes, said one of his supporters. The sit-in has halted preparatory work on the project. This is the last method we can use now. The protest will continue indefinitely if the government decides to go ahead with the project, his brother Pan Hung Sheng was quoted by AFP as saying. There's that AFP again. The city government insists that the project, estimated to cost 310 million Taiwanese dollars, about 10.5 million American, is designed to meet public demand and the trees will be replanted elsewhere. But opponents question the wisdom of removing mature trees, many of them unlikely to survive transplantation, to build the swimming pool and especially the underground parking garage, which they say is unnecessary. These trees are part of the collective memory of tens of thousands of students who have graduated from the school. It is cruel to cast off their memory, said Pan Hengsheng. He said that at least 3,000 people have expressed opposition to the project. And Daniel McGowan has been forbidden from publishing any articles without permission. In this story by Nick Pinto of the Village Voice. After more than 7 years, the stack of dehumanizing and seemingly unconstitutional interactions between Daniel McGowan and the American prison system is now piled so high it is teetering over in a recursive mess of bleak and Kafkaesque absurdity. Last Monday, McGowan published a piece on the Huffington Post that laid out much of his situation to date. After years in prison for his role in environmentally motivated property destruction that was prosecuted as acts of terrorism, he wrote, he was finishing up the remaining months of his sentence in a halfway house in Brooklyn. The various perversions of the case that sent McGowan away are well documented in the documentary If a Tree Falls, the story of the Earth Liberation Front, but, as McGowan wrote, less publicized is what happened to him a year into his prison term. Despite a flawless disciplinary record, McGowan was transferred to an experimental new communication management unit, a supermax-like extreme isolation facility some have dubbed a little Guantanamo. Why was McGowan transferred to a CMU? He never got a good answer to that question, even after a Freedom of Information Act request, so along with other CMU inmates, he filed a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the CMUs and alleging that they were effectively political prisons designed to silence the voices of people whose message the government doesn't like. As it turned out, McGowan was right. Bureau of Prison memos discovered through the lawsuit appear to link his transfer to the CMU to the fact that he continued to write things the government found politically objectionable. While incarcerated and through social correspondence and articles written for radical publications, inmate McGowan has attempted to unite the radical environmental and animal liberation movements, one memo states, before dilating on to other political statements McGowan made in interviews and in his own writings. McGowan wrote about all of this in his Huffington Post piece last Monday. 2 days later, the staff at the house, halfway house at which he had been assigned told him that his work permit had been revoked on order of the Bureau of Prisons. Next morning, federal marshals arrived and brought him to the Metropolitan Detention Center. Once there, he was presented with a document explaining that he had violated the terms of his release to the halfway house. Specifically, the incident report stated that McGowan had violated a prison regulation that stated, quote, an inmate currently confined in an institution may not act as a reporter or publish under a byline, unquote. That's right. McGowan was sent back to jail for writing about how he's been imprisoned in a CMU for writing things. There's more. The regulation that the Bureau of Prisons cited to justify returning him to jail has actually been declared unconstitutional by a federal court in 2007, and the Bureau of Prisons had actually taken it off their books in the year 2010. McGowan's lawyers mentioned this to the Bureau and the lawyers representing the government in this lawsuit, and he was re-released back to the halfway house on Friday. But that's not the end of it. Back at the halfway house, staff presented McGowan with a document and directed him to sign it. The document stated that he, quote, is not permitted to have any contact with the media without approval from the Bureau of Prisons residential reentry manager. Accordingly, resident McGowan was advised that writing articles, appearing in any type of television or media outlets, news reports, or documentaries without prior Bureau of Prisons approval is strictly prohibited. It's worth noting that McGowan hadn't been asked to sign this document when he first arrived at the halfway house, nor, as far as his lawyers can tell, has anyone else there been asked to sign it. In fact, there's nothing in the Bureau of Prisons' published media policy that requires pre-approval before publishing anything. There is no prohibition on, national prohibition on publishing, Chris Burke, a spokesman for the Bureau of Prisons, confirmed this afternoon. I thought I had lost my ability to be surprised by what the Bureau of Prison does years ago, said Rachel Muirpole, a lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights who's representing McGowan. But restricting an individual's freedom of speech in this manner is truly surprising. It's beyond ironic that Daniel was retaliated against and returned to prison for publishing a blog about being retaliated against for speaking out in prison. And a California court has given a ruling that gives hope to foes of fracking in this story by Rory Carroll and Braden Riedahl, with additional reporting by Tim Gardner in Washington, editing by Grant McCool of World Environment News Thomson Reuters. A court ruling that the U.S. government must consider the environmental impact of fracking on federal lands leased to oil companies offers opponents of the technique a useful weapon in the fierce public debate in California and other parts of the country. In a regulatory setback for hydraulic fracturing on public lands, a federal magistrate judge in San Jose, California, on Monday ruled that the Bureau of Land Management, also known as BLM, failed to analyze its impact on 2,500 acres in Monterey County. While energy lawyers were skeptical about the ruling's long-term impact, it was hailed as a victory for environmentalists trying to stop fracking in the state due to concerns about its groundwater impacts and the potential for increased fossil fuels output contributing to climate change. The ruling could even inspire environmental groups to sue the BLM in other states as oil companies accelerate their leasing of federal lands for fracking, said Brendan Cummings, a lawyer for the Center for Biological Diversity. While the ruling has most direct impact on public lands in California, it also sets an important legal and policy precedent for the federal and state agencies around the country who would be wise to heed it, said Cummings, whose group brought the suit with the Sierra Club. Celia Boddington, a spokeswoman for the BLM, said, "We are evaluating the ruling." Monterey County captures just part of the vast Monterey Shale formation estimated by the U.S. Energy Information Administration to hold 15 billion barrels of technically recoverable oil, or four times that of the Bakken formation centered in North Dakota. Most of that oil is not economically retrievable except by hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking, a production-boosting technique in which large amounts of water, sand, and chemicals are injected into shale formations to force hydrocarbon fuels to the surface. Cummings believed the San Jose ruling would likely have implications for a more recent and much larger lease sale of 18,000 acres for oil and gas development in the same general region. Judge Paul Grewal did not hand down a remedy, instead asking that the BLM and environmental groups confer and submit an agreed-upon path forward by next week. Jack Llewellyn, a Denver-based managing party at energy law firm Burleson LLP, said the potential for a time-consuming BLM environmental impact statement would put the burden on the BLM to prove a negative or that fracking would not cause damage. "If you're anti-fracking, delaying is almost as good as barring it," Llewellyn said. But James Pardo, a partner at the law firm of McDermott, Will & Emery, LLP, believed a full separate study of the Monterey Shale was unlikely to be necessary, even though the geology is different from other U.S. shale plays. "But a harder look at the issue would be necessary. The court's telling them to square these corners," he said. Note this judge did not void the leases. This judge is looking at a reasonable solution. Bill Alloyud, California Director of Government Affairs for the Environmental Working Group, said the court decision will cause the BLM to rethink how it leases land. Oil and gas drilling on BLM lands has shot up in recent years as advances in horizontal drilling and fracking have made hard-to-reach deposits recoverable. As a share of overall U.S. production, oil from federal onshore land accounted for about 5% of the total last year, or 12% for natural gas, according to federal data. About 98% of the land under BLM control is in the western United States, including Alaska. California accounts for about 6% of the 247 million acres under BLM control, according to the most recent statistics available on the agency's website. California regulators are in the process of devising rules for fracking. It is already the subject of a state-level court battle. That lawsuit, brought by the Center for Biological Diversity, Earthworks, Environmental Working Group, and Sierra Club, accuses the state regulator of failing to evaluate the risks. And a proposal to repeal California's rural fire fee has failed in committee. A Republican-authored bill to eliminate fire prevention fees levied on some California residents failed to make it out of committee Tuesday morning. Senate Bill 17 by Senator Ted Gaines, Republican of Rockland, California, fell by 4-3 in the Senate Natural Resources Water Committee. Supporters wearing bright red T-shirts bearing the phrase "Burned by the fire tax" backed the hearing room and lined up to register their support, joining fire officials and advocates for taxpayers and homeowners. No one appeared to voice opposition. The State Office of Legislative Counsel has questioned how the administration of Governor Jerry Brown spends revenue from the fee, which is assessed on property in rural areas. Lawmakers approved the fee in 2011 on a majority vote rather than the two-thirds vote required for new taxes. The revenue from the fee must be spent to benefit those who pay it. Opponents of the fee have argued that it has been used for other purposes. The Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association has sued the state on those grounds, arguing that the fee is in fact an unconstitutional tax. But some committee members said the fee was warranted to guard against blazes spreading from rural areas where they are more likely to start. Senator Hannah Beth Jackson, Democrat from Santa Barbara, California, who voted against the bill, endorsed awaiting the results of the lawsuit before moving to a legislative fix. "The issue of tax versus fee, I'm sure the courts will straighten this out," Jackson said. And Wildlife Services employee is being investigated over the death of a Mexican gray wolf in this story by Renee Romo, Journal South reporter for the Earth First Journal. Federal officials have confirmed that a Wildlife Services employee is the subject of an investigation into the killing of an endangered Mexican gray wolf in January in the southwest corner of the state. Few details about the killing have been disclosed, but spokesmen for the Wildlife Services, an arm of the U.S. Department of Agriculture and Fish and Wildlife Services, which oversees the Wolf Recovery Project, is saying that the case is under investigation. However, a brief statement from Wildlife Services indicates the employee asserted the killing was a case of mistaken identity. The employee, described as a specialist, was investigating a possible wolf depredation of livestock in January when the incident occurred, wrote Carol Bannerman, a Maryland-based spokeswoman for Wildlife Services. While on site, he lethally removed a canine, which was later identified as possibly a Mexican wolf. Bannerman wrote that the Wildlife Services employee immediately reported the take to the agency's management and to the Recovery Project's interagency field team, a group of federal, state, and tribal officials who work collaboratively on the wolf program. Asked specifically about the rumored killing of a wolf by a Wildlife Services employee, Sherry Barrett, a Mexican wolf recovery coordinator for Fish and Wildlife, said she was unable to comment and referred questions to a spokesman. Nick Chavez, special agent in charge of Fish and Wildlife Service law enforcement for the region, said that a canine mortality was being investigated. "I'm not confirming or denying it," Chavez said when asked about the killing of a wolf by a Wildlife Services employee. "It's under investigation." The killing of the lobo, only one of 75 known to roam national and tribal forest lands in a designated recovery zone in southeast Arizona and southwest New Mexico, by a federal employee would mark another setback to the hotly debated program. The illegal poaching of wolves has been the biggest cause of wolf mortality since the wolves were released into the wild, but the January incident would mark the first known case of a federal employee having killed a wolf not formally designated for removal or capture. On March 29th, the Fish and Wildlife Service noted the 15th anniversary of the date when 11 wolves were released in Arizona for the Blue Range Wolf Recovery Area. Those wolves were the descendants of the last known Mexican gray wolves, seven in all, which were captured in an effort to revive the species after ranchers and a previous incarnation of Wildlife Services trapped, hunted, and poisoned the Mexican gray wolf to near extinction in the United States and Mexico. Neither Wildlife Services nor Fish and Wildlife disclosed the exact date or location where the killing occurred and would not identify the employee involved. And a recent study says California can kiss its vineyards goodbye. In this story by Josh Richmond of the Bay Area News Group, awful as some of the climate change predictions are, this one might hit a lot of Northern California residents where it hurts, assuming their homes aren't gobbled up by the sea first. Global warming will dramatically impact many of the world's most famous wine-producing regions, according to a new study. The first ever worldwide let me start again. The first ever worldwide analysis of climate change impacts on wine production and conservation appeared recently in the Journal of Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, suggests that wine production will shift to new areas as climate change makes existing ones less hospitable. Researchers found the area suitable for wine production will shrink by as much as 73% by the year 2050 in certain parts of the globe, about 70% of them in California, with high potential for stress on rivers and other freshwater ecosystems as vineyards use water to cool grapes or irrigate to compensate for rising temperatures and declining rainfall. Climate change is going to move potential wine-producing regions all over the map, said Lee Hanna, the study's lead author and senior scientist for climate change biology at Conservation International's new Betty and Gordon Moore Center for Ecosystem Science and Economics, said in a news release. These global changes put the squeeze on wildlife and nature's capacity to sustain human life in some surprising places, Hanna said. Consumer awareness, industry, and conservation actions are all needed to keep high-quality wine flowing without unintended consequences for nature and the flows of goods and services it provides people. This is just the tip of the iceberg. It will be the same for many other crops. Researchers looked at 9 major wine-producing areas: California, Western North America, Chile, Mediterranean Europe, Northern Europe, Cape Floristic region of South Africa, parts of Australia with Mediterranean climate, parts of Australia with non-Mediterranean climate, and New Zealand. Chile and California are areas with traditions of irrigation and high freshwater impact index values, indicating that their freshwater habitats may be most at risk as a result of climate change impacts on vineyard water use, the study found. Adaptation strategies involving viticulture, vinification, marketing, land use planning, and water management can all help avoid conflicts with conservation objectives in the areas declining as well as expanding suitability. Another key finding from the study is that new areas will become more productive, including parts of Western North America and Northern Europe. These places at higher latitudes and higher elevations will become increasingly suitable for winemaking and sought after by vineyards as they search for the climatic conditions that are ideal for wine grape growing. According to the study, the greatest area of increasing wine production suitability is in the Rocky Mountains near the Canadian-U.S. border, putting at risk species such as the grizzly bear, gray wolf, and pronghorn antelope. Climate change will set up competition for land between agriculture and wildlife. Wine grapes are but one example, said Rebecca Shaw, the study's co-author and associate vice president for the Environmental Defense Fund's Land, Water, and Wildlife Program. This could have disastrous results for wildlife. Fortunately, there are proactive solutions. We are creating incentive-based programs with private landowners to provide wildlife habitat as we expand our capacity to feed a growing planet in the future under a changing climate. And that's all the time we have for the Earth First update this week. The Earth First update is produced every Thursday at 9 o'clock on Free Radio Santa Cruz, and rebroadcast on Friday afternoons at 3 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 and also at www.freakradio.org. You can also listen to the Earth First Update on Radio Free Moscow, KRFP, Idaho, at 92.5 FM on Monday nights at 9:30. You can also download or listen online at radioforall.net. Just search for Earth First Update. Be sure to put the exclamation point in, radioforall.net. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We want to thank you for listening and do tune in next time for another edition of the Earth First Update.